I am Henry Atherton. I was born in Eden, November 12, 1923. My dad died when I was four, so we ended up in Glover, where I was brought up and graduated from Barton Academy in 1941 and went on from there. I was a 4-H member for a number of years during the 1930s. I had a chicken project at the time, and always one of the fond memories was the 4-H camp. Actually, I think Flora Coots was the agent at the time, the one that the camp is named for now. Willis Edwards was my 4-H leader. He passed away in 1938, so obviously my 4-H career was in the middle 30s, from probably 1933 to 1938. Very enjoyable. Did the swimming bit and advanced there, had a great time. And Willis was a great leader. He took us on a lot of agricultural trips around the Northeast Kingdom. And it was a fun beginning. Well, actually, I was born on a farm in Eden, but after Dad died, Mother was unable to handle it, so it went back. And then she married my stepfather in Glover, and Mother was the real farmer of my mom and dad. And as I grew up, we had four cows, bred heifers, usually a couple of pigs and all the garden and all the other, very much a self-sustained operation, buying the necessities at the store, the things she couldn't grow. But for a number of years there, she set the milk in the water tub, saved the cream, made butter, cottage cheese, which I peddled there in the town up through there through those years. Always remember the cottage cheese money was mine, quote unquote. That went to buy clothes and what have you, but she did a lot of roadside sales of the surplus supplies. We traded eggs and butter for the staples up at the store. Picked berries, sold those. I mean, it was very much a, well, it's in there. I got a magazine for a number of years called Reminisce, but we had everything but money. That was basically the thing. And, I did that until I went over to UVM. I had a year and a half at UVM before I went into the service. Then came back and joined the staff and put in 36 years on staff. Well, I came back to the university in 1953. I had a year and a half here before I went into service, and I came back. With the GI Bill, it took me within about 7 months of my PhD at Penn State. Came back just as Hood, Hood and Borden were converting to bulk tanks. And so, literally, my career developed around bulk tanks and helping the farmers cope with this new phenomenon. And I started out, like most other graduate students do, with an appointment starting 1953, teaching and research. And then the research, literally, we didn't have a bulk tank at the university at that time, and so I was riding around with a bulk collector collecting milk samples from those bulk tanks. And Bob Davison was head of the extension at the time, and it got to the point where I was spending quite a lot of my time out working with the farmers on quality control, getting them to meet the inspection standards and the bacterial standards and what have you. And so we started out that if I was doing the work, I'd ought to get part of the budget ought to be paid by extension. So it started out at 10% extension and kept on going until it built up. So the last, dozen or 15 years or more, I was 50-50 teaching and extension rather. Still doing some research on the side, but a main thrust outside of class was working out there with the dairymen, coping with, as I say, and it turned out, of course, the cold temperature bacteria were very important in a bulk handling and the long shelf life that they were getting. And I had done my PhD work at Penn State on the cold temperature bacteria. So I guess I was one of the pioneers, really, in adapting that study of the effect of the so-called psychotrophs on milk quality coming on through the years. And literally, ADSA, American Dairy Science, just put out a 100-year historical volume, and I was credited in that as being one of the pioneers in bulk tank and psychotroph research, so I'm rather proud of that. It was total chaos because, see, I came back, joined the 1st of July, and just about that time, or a little earlier in the spring, Hood and Borden had announced as of the 1st of September they were going to be on bulk tanks. Well, that was my first research, knowing I think there were 12 farmers that were involved in the shift over at the time. And so my first research was comparing the quality of the milk while they were still on these few months of can cooling, and then succeeding months on bulk tanks. And so, as I say, that led into a career, literally, of dealing with the quality of milk under the bulk tank system of cooling milk. But as far as the farmers were concerned, it meant new milk houses, roads for the trucks to get into the thing. The whole idea of milk movement, and then as a result of the wartime economies on rubber and gasoline, milk was picked up every other day rather than day by day as had been common under the can cooling system. So it just became matter of fact that they would pick up milk on a two-day basis. And one of my real early involvements in it, the bacteria counts are made on the milk, and it's a lab in St. Albans or St. Johnsbury, would be low. When that same milk got to Boston, it would be basically illegal. The count would be so great. Well, again, this was a factor of the psychotrophs, which no one really knew that much about. And that was the thing with the farmers. The old idea of stainless steel wool and elbow grease to do their cleaning just didn't do it. And so we had these buildups that developed on the bulk tanks, and that was very much a part of my job, was identifying where these psychotrophs might be hiding and multiplying, getting into the milk stream here at the farm, not showing up in the results upcountry, but very definitely a part in the keeping quality as they got down to the city markets. So what I did was get the samples up here at the farm. And then traditionally, it came to me that this milk would be from 24 to 48 hours old when it got down to Boston. So I would take duplicate samples, or actually triplicate samples, and hold one immediately, and then put the other one in the refrigerator for 48 hours, and hold it and run it again. And found out that, during that 48 hours, these samples that I had, sterile samples to start with, were blooming. We called them blow-ups. And about that time, Dr. C.K. Johns, was head of the bacteria department in Ottawa, was a personal friend of Alec Bradfield that I was working with. And he came up with a procedure based on some work that he had done, a study in England, where he held these raw samples for 18 hours at 45 degrees. And this really gave the psychotrophs a chance to begin multiplying. So then I did some work comparing my study, holding them for 40 hours at 40 degrees, with CK's work, holding them 18 hours at 45, and came in with this process called preliminary incubation, which is still used today as an indication of pork sanitation back at the farm. And so you've got a number of companies today that pay a premium on the basis of a low so-called PI, preliminary incubation count. That was all part of my actual beginning back there in the 50s and 60s. And as I say, we were dealing with a subject who was totally foreign to the traditional farmer, the fieldman, the regulatory people. None of them had a handle on this. So we did a lot of work during those first years. And again, this is pretty much another phase of my adventure into extension. The head of the dairy division at the university at Montpelier, and I, and about that same time, the late 50s and very early 60s, Vermont started an initial milk flavor program. Alec Bradfield and Harold Clark from the State Department, and I ran around all over the place with meetings of fieldmen and bull callers and farmers and what have you, talking about this whole general area of actually coping with the quality of milk under a bulk handling system. So I say it. Bob Davison figured I was spending more time out there in the field. Actually, ought to be getting extension credit for it. These large bulk tanks and the sinks and all the other things that they had to have. There were a lot. You ought to go back into the 30s. And there were many, many farmers in the area, in fact, the country, that would have a dozen or 15 cows and then work off the farm. And so, as I say, there was just no way for a 12 or 15 cow, 18 cow dairy could even hope to handle these expenses of modifying their farm. Many times they just new stables, new milk houses particularly. But to say, with the roads that they had to get in there to handle those trucks, it was just chaos. And so you just find farm after farm area here in the state where these little guys would go out of business. And many of them had... Many of them had been born on those farms, married on those farms, raised their families, Well, they kept the farm and the field. Fields went out to other farmers because in order to handle this expense, those 15, 18 cow dairies had to put on more cows to make it pay, which meant they had to have more land, and on it went. It was just a cycle of activity during that 1950-1960 era. And there was just a complete changeover in the dairy industry. And as we see, the farmers are still dropping out for whatever reason in a continuing decline of farms in the state of Vermont. But again, of course, along with this whole general area, as we came back from the war, you got into the new fields of animal breeding, animal nutrition, what have you. Extension put on specialists. The county agents were trained in these fields, and so they were involved with that side. My field basically was taken from the milk house to the consumer, but there was an equal movement along that same time with the milk production side of it in there. So the whole dairy industry, literally, it was almost as much of a revolution as the Industrial Revolution of the mid-1800s had been, going from the little self-independent farms into a milk industry. I think what we are seeing, no question, there is a attitude towards raw milk. I am very much involved in that, in fact. We have a younger generation who, I guess I liken it to using a helmet on a motorcycle. Personal choice in here, accepting the risk, and there's no question that there is a health situation as far as raw milk is concerned. You're not going to convince the regulatory that are responsible for public health that people should drink raw milk. Well, I didn't have pasteurized milk till I came to college. There are many the same story. And so I guess I would say I have mixed emotions as far as the idea is concerned. There's no question about it. We can quote literally case after case where some of the new pathogens that have come up are causing a problem with raw milk. We've seen a situation where school children or farmers have been forbidden for giving touring kids milk and cookies on their visits. It's a movement that is not going to stop. In many respects, most respects, milk is a safe product, recognized as a safe product, and yet any of us that are involved with public health, and I've been associated with the Food and Drug FDA workers, I guess, since the early 60s. And so I share their feelings that there's no way that they can accept the premise that people should be drinking raw milk. And yet they know people are going to do it. So to me, I guess that is a story in there that many cases, an accident waiting to happen, but people are better educated than they were 50, 60 years ago. They have to make educated choices, and so they are doing it and will continue to do it, and probably will continue. The other thing, your second question, that has to do with farmers, what we are seeing very definitely is dairy farms are being used in a different way. This whole business of homegrown cheese and different products that they're coming up with. We are talking about goat milk, we're talking about buffalo milk, we're talking about, you know, all of these products that have come in, the artistic things, the farmers markets and things like that. There's just many young farmers out there that literally do nothing about dairying, but have taken on the responsibility of a dairy, and we're seeing them again. Well, we got 38 or so different small cheese manufacturers here in the state now, and of course we've got the Kathy Donnellys and Paul Kinsteads and those that are in turn working with them, and can't speak for them, but again, I'm sure they're seeing the same thing as it relates to raw milk cheeses and those kinds of things. People are going to make them and people are going to buy them. So, no, I think this is the thing that we are seeing. I am concerned about the number of dairies that are going out because of this low price situation. I don't know what they are going to do, but as I say, you've got still, again, many of these dairymen that have grown up on the farm, married on the farm, raised their family on the farm, and probably they're going to keep on in those buildings but find other uses for their hay land and what have you through the year. I think a lot of them are probably very concerned about what their future, because they're at an age when they aren't likely to take on a new profession. So it's a very critical time right now. I don't think we have seen a time, really, even with the conversion days of the 50s, where my concern is the effect it's going to have. I was just reading, actually, I still get the Chronicle, which is a Orleans County weekly paper, but talking about the Boylan farm there in Glover that's just had a dispersal. Now, I grew up with the Boylans, and their son has been running this farm. Well, again, they're concerned about the effect it's going to have on the feed merchants, going to affect on the storekeepers, tax base in towns. I mean, I think we are in a real serious situation as far as, because now, as I say, you have a 200 or 300 cow dairy that goes out of business. It has a lot more effect on everybody around than back there when a 12 or 18 cow dairy went out of business. Just as hard on the individual dairy person, but by the same token, the side effects on society are really, really critical, I think. Frankly, I'm not an economist, and with the movement of milk, what it is, you can move milk across the country and have it increase in temperature 1 or 2 degrees. And so you've got these major dairies again there in the Texas area, California, Idaho, what have you, that are just producing tons of milk, and they can do it cheaper than well, we can do it over here. We do have the benefit of a large population base in easy shipping distance, but as I say, they can get milk in here from Wisconsin or what have you, basically is as cheap as a Boston dealer can from Vermont. So I don't know, the economics really is troublesome. I think you have a co-op like Agrimark that has the cheese facility and the drying may be able to cope, but you wonder just how long the little niche dairies like Monument Farms and some of the others that are very much a part of our culture, my preferred milk, the problems they will have meeting that competition. You got Dean Foods that controls Gorelick. You know, Dean Foods big enough, they can ship milk all around the country without any real problem. I think we're going to have some real serious problems, and it may very well be that the cheese industry may be one of our major outlets, but we've got to get into some value-added product in here in order to cope, because I don't think there's enough money in market milk to hope that 20 years from now it'll be a viable outlet. It's scary. And it's hard, particularly for a dairyman who had built up this dairy with the idea that sons or daughters are coming on and can take over when dad and mom leave, and rather the opportunity is going to be there for them. When I left 20 years ago, it was not all that bad, but I think right now we are in a critical situation which may be comparable to the questions that existed on a different scale in the 50s, but for the individual dairyman, I think the challenges are still there. You have companies or dairies that put in robots or some of the other things. Labor situation, what it is. In there, again, you've got politics involved in the immigration situation, but many of these farmers would be in trouble if they didn't have the illegal immigrants to do the workaday work. So it's hard. It's hard to legislate. It's hard to operate. I think probably need extension activities as much or more than at any time in history, because literally there's almost no help out there for these dairymen that have some mighty big decisions to make. I think that if we look at extension as the provider of technical information, I don't know of any other group that is going to be able to fill that role. I think extension specialists are out there, be them building specialists or quality people or nutritionists or what have you, but someone is going to have to answer these questions. With all the consolidations, we aren't seeing the field representatives out there that we had back in the 50s. And back then, the Hoods and the Bordens and the others all had representatives out there in the field helping the dairymen. They just aren't there anymore. And as the companies have consolidated, this professional organization of mine, International Association of Milk, Food, Environmental Sanitarians, is now the International Association for Food Protection. They're interested in food safety, not quality control, not all these other things that were in there as activists when I was getting started. But someone is going to have to fill that role, because the farmer can't be all everything. And someone's got to provide some specialists in these various fields, breeding, nutrition. building maintenance, what have you, to help them out. There's a lot of work ahead, and it gets more complicated. The bigger they get, the more complicated the problems become. And you get some disease into a herd, and you can wipe out a fortune in a hurry. Again, a hurricane go through, or a fire, or what have you, and you've really got some real major questions. Do we rebuild or go out of business? My stepfather had literally lost everything when the Newport Bank, he was a retired farmer, and lost everything. So when he passed away, just a few years after they were married, they literally left the house, and that was about it. Survive, but I don't think there were many of them there in the town of Glover that really looked on as being funded. Our contribution to the church was 2 pounds of butter a week for the minister. I think a poor minister and the doctors got more produce than they did money, but they did the service, and literally, you didn't have the money, they served them anyway. It was a different life, entirely a different life. But as I say, now, with the downturns that we've had, clearly, as I say, we just learned not to go in debt. And didn't. Wouldn't think of carrying a credit card balance, which is killing many, many people. So, the lessons of the Depression years were lasting, but very good. But as I say, as I look back at the things that Mother did, 3 boys to bring up without a loan, but again, no way would she go in debt. The industry is different, entirely different than what it was in 1990. But a lot of good friends out there, scattered around the country. I was fortunate, actually. Tom Dow, Dean, back when I was a neophyte here, and he said, "You got to get out there and talk to people. Vermont's a milk exporting state. They aren't going to come up here and talk to you. You've got to go and talk to them." So he was very supportive of my getting into these regional and national organizations. And it just made for a great career and thoroughly enjoyable.